Chapter 25. A Pitched Battle in Hell. We now saw before us a vast, slightly undulating plain upon which great masses of dark spirits were moving. At Faithful Friend's suggestion, we ascended a small hillock that we might observe their movements. "We are now," said Faithful Friend, "about to witness one of the great battles that take place here between the opposing forces of dark spirits whose delight was in war and its rapine and bloodshed, and who, here in the dark state which is the result of their earthly cruelty and ambition, carry on yet their warlike operations against each other and contend for the supremacy of these kingdoms of hell. Behold how they are massing their forces for an attack upon those others on our right, and observe the skill they will display in their maneuvers. The powerful minds of men who swayed armies on earth sway such unhappy beings here as are not strong enough to resist their spell, and thus they force these less powerful spirits to fight under their banners whether they will or not, just as they did with mortals on earth. You will see these powerful leaders engage in a struggle worse than deadly, since no death can come to end the contest, which they renew over and over again, as it would almost seem eternally, or until, as is to be hoped, the satiety of mind of one or other of these powerful leaders will at last make him long for some nobler form of contest, some higher triumph of the soul than is won over these miserable beings in battles where victory gives only a fresh right to torture and oppress the vanquished. The same instincts and natural gifts which are now perverted to personal ambition and the lust for cruelty and dominion as their only aim, will, when purified, make these spirits mighty helpers, where now they are destroyers, and the same powers of will help forward the progress they now retard. When this progress shall take place depends, for each, upon the latent nobility of the soul itself, the awakening of the dormant love of goodness and justice and truth to be found in all. Though like seeds in the earth these germs of better things may lie long hidden beneath the mass of evil that overloads them, there must and does come a time for each when the better soul awakens and these germs of good send out shoots that lead to repentance and bring forth an abounding harvest of virtue and good works. We looked over the vast plain and now beheld the two mighty hosts of spirits drawn up to confront one another in the array of battle. Here and there I beheld powerful spirits, leading each his band or regiment as in an earthly army. In the van of the opposing forces were two majestic beings who might have been models for Milton's Lucifer, so strong was the sense of power and high intellect with which they impressed me. In each there was a certain beauty and grandeur of form and feature, a regal majesty even in the degradation of hell, but alas! The beauty was that of a wild fierce tiger or lion that watches how he may rend his army in pieces and drag his prey into his den. Dark and forbidding were their countenances, cruel and ferocious their gleaming eyes, the false smile, showing their sharp teeth like those animals of prey. The cunning of the serpent was in their looks, and the pitiless hunger of the vulture in their smile. Each rode in his chariot of war drawn, not by horses, but by the spirits of degraded men, whom they lashed forward as beasts of burden and drove furiously on to be trampled down in the melee as cattle. Wild strains of music that sounded like the shrieks of the souls of the damned and the thunders of a mighty storm broke from the assembled armies, and with one fell swoop they rushed forward and bore down upon each other, flying and hurrying through the air, or dragging themselves along the ground. Pushing, hustling, jostling, and trampling like a herd of wild animals on they came, and as they met, their fierce cries and shouts and imprecations rent the air and made even hell more hideous. They charged and recharged, they maneuvered, marched, and countermarched, these phantom spirit armies of the dead, even as they had done in the battles of earth life. They fought and wrestled like demons, not men, for they had no weapons save those of wild beasts, their teeth and claws. If a battle with mortal weapons is horrible, this was doubly so, where they fought as wolves and tigers might, the two powerful leaders directing the mass, urging them on and guiding the fight as the tide of battle swept back one side or the other. Over all had towered these two dark regal spirits, and now no longer content to let their soldiers fight, but bent each upon the destruction of the other, they rose from the fighting mass, and, soaring high above them, turned their looks upon each other with deadliest hate, then flying through the air with their dark robes extended behind and above them like wings, They grappled and wrestled together in a fierce struggle for supremacy. It was as though two eagles fought in midair while a mass of carrion crows grubbed and fought for worms beneath them. I turned from the crows to watch the eagles and to mark how, with no weapons but their hands and their powerful wills, they fought as wild beasts do in a forest. They uttered no sound, no cry, but gripped each other with a death grip that neither would relax, and swayed to and fro in the air before us. Now one upward, now the other, their fierce eyes stabbing each other with fiery darts, their hot breath scorching each other's faces, their fingers clutching at each other's throats, and both seeking for a chance to fasten on their enemy with their teeth. Backwards and forwards, up and down they swayed and writhed in what seemed a mere death struggle for both. At last one seemed to fail. He sank below the other, who was bearing him to the ground to dash him, as I saw, over a deep precipice into a chasm in the rocks that skirted the field of battle, a deep and dark and awful pit into which he meant to hurl the vanquished one, and keep him prisoner. Fierce and long was the struggle, for the one below would not give in and clung to the other to drag him down with him if possible. But in vain. His powers were failing fast, and as they reached the black chasm and hung poised over it, I saw the uppermost one wrench himself free by a mighty effort and fling the other from him, down into those awful depths. With a shudder I turned away and saw that the battle had been raging as fiercely on the plain. Those spectral hosts had fought, and the army of the victorious general had beaten back the forces of his vanquished foe till they were broken and dispersed in all directions, leaving their disabled comrades on the field lying as wounded men do in an earthly battle, while the victors were dragging away with them their captives, to what fate I could only too well guess. Sickened and disgusted with their brutishness, I would fain have left this place, but faithful friend, touching my shoulder, said, "Now has come the time for our work, my friend. Let us descend yonder and see if there are none whom we can help. Amongst the fallen and vanquished we may find those who are as sick of war and its horrors as you, and who will be but too glad of our help." So we went down to the plain. It was as might have been a battlefield when night has fallen upon it and there are but the wounded and the slain left behind. All the other spirits had gone like a flock of evil birds to seek fresh carrion. I stood among a writhing, moaning mass of beings and knew not where to begin my help, there were so many. It was worse, a thousand times worse than any mortal battlefield. I have seen the dead and dying lying in the streets of my native town thick as fallen leaves, and my heart has ached and bled for them and burned with shame and anger that such things could be, but even there was at least the peace and sleep of death to soften the anguish, and there was the hope of helping those who yet lived. But here in this awful hell there seemed no hope and no death that could relieve these suffering ones, no morning that should dawn upon the night of their miseries. If they revived, would it not be to live again this awful life, to find themselves surrounded ever by this awful night, and these fierce wild beasts of men? I stooped down and tried to raise the head of one poor wretch who lay moaning at my feet crushed till his spirit body seemed but a shapeless mass, and as I did so the mysterious voice spoke in my ears and said, "Even in hell there is hope, or why else are you come? The darkest hour is ever before the dawn, and for these the vanquished and the fallen has come the hour of their change. The very cause that has made them to be thus borne down and trampled under is that which shall now raise them. The desire for higher and better things, the shrinking from the evil around them, has rendered them weak in the wickedness which is the strength of hell and its inhabitants, and has made them waver and hesitate to thrust at and harm another with the ruthless force of these other wild and worthless beings, and thus they have been borne down and vanquished, but their fall from power here will open to them the doors of a higher state, and thus shall there dawn for them the grey glimmer of a higher hope. Mourn not for them, but seek to ease their sufferings that they may sink into a sleep of death to this sphere and waken to a new life in the sphere next above." "And what," I asked, "of that powerful spirit whom I saw thrown into the dark chasm?" "He too will be helped in time, but his soul is not yet ripe for help, and it is of no use to try till then." The voice ceased, and faithful friend, who was beside me, made signs to show me how to soothe these weary ones to sleep, and pointed out to me numerous stars of light which had gathered on that field of pain, and said they were carried by those of our brotherhood who were, like ourselves, drawn here on their mission of love and mercy. Ere long the writhing, moaning forms had sunk into unconsciousness, and a short time after I saw a sight that was strange and wonderful indeed. Over each silent form there arose a faint misty floating vapor, such as I had seen once before in the case of a spirit we had rescued, as I have already told. Gradually these vapors took shape and solidity and assumed the form of the released spirit or soul, then each was borne away by bands of bright ethereal spirits who had gathered above our heads till the last was gone and our work and theirs was done. Chapter 26, Farewell to the Dark Land. I now perceived that those brothers of hope, who like myself had been assisting the poor wounded spirits, all belonged to the same company as myself, and they were all collecting together the little starry lights we each carried, looking indeed like emblems of hope in darkness. Faithful friend and I joined the others and were soon interchanging greetings and congratulations, like a brigade of soldiers about to return home after a successful campaign. Before we again passed through the fiery ring that encompassed this region, the leader of our band conducted us to the top of a high pinnacle of rock from which we beheld the cities and plains and mountains of that land of darkness, through which each of us had passed in our pilgrimage. And standing on that mountain peak we could survey the mighty panorama of hell stretched out at our feet. He then addressed us in grave, solemn tones, "This scene upon which we look is but a small, a very small, fractional portion of the great sphere which men have been wont to speak of as hell. There are dark spheres above this which may seem to many to deserve the name until they have seen this place and learned in it how low a soul can sink and how much more terrible in this sphere can be both the crimes and the sufferings. The great belt of dark matter of which is composed this, the lowest of the earth's spheres, extends for many million miles around us, and has received within its borders all those multitudes of sinful souls whose material lives have been passed on earth, and whose existences date back to the remote far-off ages in which the planet Earth first began to bear its harvest of conscious immortals, destined to sin and suffer and work out each their own salvation till they should be purified from all earthly stain, all taint of their lower nature. The multitudes of such lives have been, and shall yet be, as the stars of the sky and the sands of the sea in number, and as each builds for himself his own habitation in the higher or in the lower spheres, so are the vast spheres peopled and their many dwelling places and cities formed. Far beyond the power of any mortal to carry even his thoughts, lie the myriad dwelling places of the spheres, each spot or locality bearing upon it the individual stamp of the spirit whose life has created it, and as there are no two faces, no two minds, exactly similar in all the countless beings that have peopled the earth, so there are no two places in the spirit world exactly alike. Each place, yea, even each sphere, is the separate creation of the particular class of minds that have created it, and those whose minds are in affinity being drawn to each other in the spirit world, every place will bear more or less the peculiar stamp of its inhabitants. Thus, in giving a description of this or any other sphere, you will naturally be able to tell only what you have seen, and to describe those places to which you were attracted, while another spirit who has beheld a different portion of the same sphere may describe it so very differently that men on earth, who limit all things to much, and measure them by their own standards of probability, will say that since you differ in describing the same sphere, you must both be wrong. They forget that Rome is not Genoa, Milan, or Venice, yet these are all in Italy. Lyon is not Paris, yet both are in France, and both will bear certain characteristic features, certain national traits of resemblance. Or to extend the simile still further, New York and Constantinople are both cities upon the planet Earth, yet there is between them and their population so great a difference, so wide a gulf, that it requires that we should look no longer for national characteristics but only for the broad fact that both are inhabited by the human race, differing, however widely, in manners and appearance. And now I would have you each observe that in all your wanderings, in all the sad sights you have seen, all the unhappy beings you have known groveling in this sink of their own iniquities, there were yet the germs of human souls inextinguishable and undestroyable, and you have each learned, I trust, that long as may be the probation of the soul, greatly as it may retard the hour of its release by the perversion of its powers, yet to all is given the inalienable birthright of hope, and to each will come at last the hour of awakening, and those who have sunk to the lowest depths will arise even as a pendulum swung to its farthest limit will arise and swing back again as high as it has sunk low. Bitter and awful is the reckoning the sinful soul must pay for its wild indulgence in evil, but once paid there is not again that reckoning to be met. There is no inexorable creditor whose ears are deaf to the voice of prayer, or who will say to the repentant prodigal, "Begone, for your doom is sealed and the hour of your redemption past." Oh, brethren of hope! Can man in his littleness measure the power of the Almighty whose ways are past his finding out? Can man put a limit to his mercy and say it shall be denied to any sorrowful sinner, however deep has been his sin? God alone can condemn, and he alone can pardon, and his voice cries out to us in everything, in every blade of grass that grows, in every ray of light that shines. How great is the goodness and mercy of our God, how long-suffering and how slow to anger! And his voice calls with trumpet tongue, through his many angels and ministering spirits, to all who repent and seek for mercy, that mercy is ever given, pardon, full and free, is granted unto all who earnestly seek it and would truly labor that they may win it. Even beyond the grave, even within the gates of hell itself, there is yet mercy and pardon, yet hope and love held out to all. Not one atom of the immortal soul essence which has been breathed into man and become a living conscious individuality is ever again truly lost, wholly doomed either to annihilation or eternal misery. They I had almost said they sin, who teach man otherwise, for by so doing they shut a door upon his hopes and render the erring soul yet more desperate because more hopeless, when, as he deems, death has put the final seal of damnation upon his fate. I would when each of you returns to the earth plane that you proclaim to all this truth which you have learned in these your wanderings, and strive ever that each and all may feel the sense of hope and the need there is to take heed to their ways while there is yet time. Far easier were it for man in his earth life to undo his misdeeds than if he wait till death has placed his barrier between him and those to whom he would atone. In those hells which you have seen, all has been the outcome of men's own evil lives, the works of their own past, either upon earth or in its spheres. There is nothing but what has been the creation of the soul itself, however horrible to you may appear its surroundings. However shocked you may have felt at the spiritual appearance of these beings, yet must you ever remember that such as they are, have they made themselves. God has not added one grain's weight to the burden of any, and equally must it be the work of each to undo what he has done, to build up again what he has destroyed, to purify what he has debased. And then will these wretched dwellings, these degraded forms, these fearful surroundings be exchanged for brighter and happier scenes, purer bodies, more peaceful homes, and when at last in the fullness of time the good on earth and in its spheres shall overcome the bad, the evil sights and evil places will be swept away as the froth upon the sea is swept on by the advancing tide, and the pure water of life shall flow over these spots and purify them till these solid black mountains, this dense heavy atmosphere, and these foul dwelling places shall melt in the strong purifying fire of repentance, even as the hard granite rock is melted in the crucible of the chemist till it is dissipated into the atmosphere and floated away to form other rocks elsewhere. Nothing is ever lost, nothing ever destroyed. All things are imperishable. Those atoms which your body has attracted to it today are thrown off again tomorrow, and pass on to form other bodies eternally, as these emanations of men's spiritual natures are formed into the earth spheres, and when there is no longer magnetism sufficiently gross to hold together these gross particles which form the lower spheres, these atoms will become detached from following the earth and its sphere in their rushing journey through the limitless ether of space, and will float in suspension in the ether till drawn to another planet whose spheres are congenial and whose spiritual inhabitants are on an equally gross plane. Thus these same rocks and this country have all formed in the past the lower spheres of other planets which have now grown too highly developed to attract them, and they will, when this, our Earth, has ceased to attract them, be drawn off and form the spheres of some other planet. So too are our higher spheres formed of matter more etherealized, yet still matter, which has been cast off from planet spheres much in advance of ours, and in like manner these atoms will be left by us and reabsorbed in turn by our successor. Nothing is lost, nothing wasted, nothing is really new. The things called new are but new combinations of that which exists already, and is in its nature eternal. To what ultimate height of development we shall reach, I know not, none can know, since there can be no limit to our knowledge or our progress. But I believe that could we foresee the ultimate destiny of our own small planet, as we can in part judge of it from seeing the more advanced ones around us, we should learn to look upon even the longest earthly life and the longest, saddest probation of these dark spheres as but stepping stones on which man shall mount to the thrones of angels at last. What we can see, what we do know and may grasp, is the great and ever-present truth that hope is truly eternal and progression is ever possible even to the lowest and the most degraded and sin-stained soul. It is this great truth we would have each of you to preach both to mortal and immortal man, when you return to the earth planes and to your work there, and as you have been helped and strengthened and taught, so do you feel bound by the obligations of gratitude and the ties of universal brotherhood to help others. Let us now bid farewell to this dark land, not in sorrow over its sadness and its sins, but in hope and with earnest prayer for the future of all who are yet in the bonds of suffering and sin. As our great leader concluded his speech, we took our last look at the dark country, and, descending the mountain, we passed once more through the ring of fire, which, as before, was by our will power driven back on either side of us that we might pass through in safety. Thus ended my wanderings in the kingdoms of hell. Part 4, Through the Gates of Gold. Chapter 27, Welcome on our return, a magic mirror, work in the cities of earth, the land of remorse, the valley of phantom mists, a home of rest. On our return to the land of dawn, we met with a right royal welcome from our brotherhood, and a festival was given in our honor. On entering our own little rooms, each of us found a new robe awaiting him. It was of a very light gray, almost white color, and the border, girdle, and device of our order, an anchor and a star upon the left sleeve, were in deep gold and yellow. I greatly prize this new dress because in the spirit world the dress symbolizes the state of advancement of the spirit, and is esteemed as showing what each one has attained. What I prized even more than this new dress, however, was a most beautiful wreath of pure white spirit roses which I found had clustered around and framed the magic picture of my beloved Ephraim that never withered, never faded, and whose fragrance was wafted to me as I reposed on the snow-white couch and gazed out upon those peaceful hills behind which there shone the dawning day. I was aroused from my reverie by a friend who came to summon me to the festival, and on entering the great hall I found my father and some friends of my wanderings awaiting me. We greeted one another with much emotion, and after we had enjoyed a banquet similar to the one I have described on my first entrance to this sphere, we all assembled at the lower end of the hall before a large curtain of grey and gold which completely covered the walls. While we waited in expectation of what we were to see, a soft strain of music floated towards us as though borne upon some passing breeze. This grew stronger, fuller, more distinct, till a solemn majestic measure like the march of an army fell upon our ears. Not a march of triumph or rejoicing, but one such as might be played by an army of giants mourning over a dead comrade, so grand, so full of pathos was this strain. Then the curtains glided apart and showed us a huge mirror of black polished marble. And then the music changed to another measure, still solemn, still grand, but with somewhat of discordance in its tones. It wavered too and became uneven in the measure of its time, as though halting with uncertain step, stumbling and hesitating. Then the air around us darkened till we could scarce see each other's faces, slowly the light faded, and at last all we could see was the black polished surface of the gigantic mirror, and in it I saw reflected the figures of two of the members of our expedition. They moved and spoke, and the scenery around them grew distinct and such as I had seen in the inferno we had left. The weird music stirred my soul to its inmost core, and looking upon the drama being enacted before my eyes, I forgot where I was, I forgot everything, and seemed to be wandering once more in the dark depths of hell. Picture melted into picture, till we had been shown the varied experiences of each of our bank, from the lowest member to our leader himself, the last scene showing the whole company assembled upon the hill listening to the farewell discourse of our commander, and like the chorus in a Greek tragedy, the wild music seemed to accompany and explain it all, varying with every variation in the dramas, now sad and sorrowful, now full of repose or triumph, and again wailing, sobbing, shrieking or changing into a murmuring lullaby as some poor rescued soul sank to rest at last, then again rising into wild notes of clamor, fierce cries of battle, hoarse curses and imprecations, now surging in wild waves of tumultuous melody, then dying away amidst discordant broken notes. At last, as the final scene was enacted, it sank into a soft plaintive air of most exquisite sweetness, and died away note by note. As it ceased, the darkness vanished, the curtains glided over the black mirror, and we all turned with a sigh of relief and thankfulness to congratulate each other that our wanderings in that dark land were past. I asked my father how this effect had been produced. Was it an illusion or what? "My son," he answered, "what you have seen is an application of scientific knowledge, nothing more. This mirror has been so prepared that it receives and reflects the images thrown upon it from a series of sheets of thin metal, or rather what is the spiritual counterpart of earthly metal. These sheets of metal have been so highly sensitized that they are able to receive and retain these pictures somewhat in the fashion of a phonograph, such as you saw in Earth life, receives and retains the sound waves. When you were wandering in those dark spheres, you were put in magnetic communication with this instrument, and the adventures of each were transferred to one of these sensitive sheets, while the emotions of every one of you caused the sound waves in the spheres of music and literature to vibrate in corresponding tones of sympathy. You belong to the spheres of art, music and literature, and therefore you are able to see and feel and understand the vibrations of those spheres. In the spirit world, all emotions, speeches, or events reproduce themselves in objective forms and become for those in harmony with them either pictures, melodies, or spoken narratives. The spirit world is created by the thoughts and actions of the soul, and therefore every act or thought forms its spiritually material counterpart. In this sphere you will find many things not yet known to men on earth, many curious inventions which will in time be transmitted to earth and clothed there in material form. But see, you are about to receive the palm branch which is given to each of you as a reward of your victory." At this moment the large doors of the hall were once more thrown open and our Grand Master entered, followed by the same train of handsome youths I had seen before, only this time each carried a branch of palm instead of a wreath of laurel. When the Grand Master had seated himself under his canopy of state, we were each summoned to his presence to receive our branch of palm, and when we had all done so and returned to our places again, a most joyous hymn of victory was sung by everyone, our palm branches waving in time to the music and our glad voices filling the air with triumphant harmony. I now enjoyed a long quiet season of rest which much resembled that half-waking, half-sleeping state, when the mind is too much in repose to think and yet retains full consciousness of all its surroundings. From this state, which lasted some weeks, I arose completely recovered from the effects of my wanderings in the dark spheres. And my first thought was to visit my beloved, and see if she could see me and be conscious of my improved appearance. I shall not, however, dwell upon our interview. Its joy was for ourselves alone. I only seek to show that death does not of necessity either end our affection for those we have left or shut us out from sharing with them our joys or sorrows. I found that I was now much more able to communicate with her through her own mediumistic powers, so that we did not need any third person to intervene and help us, and thus were my labors lightened and cheered by her sweet affection and her conscious recognition of my presence and of my continued existence. My work at this time was once more upon the earth plane and in those cities whose counterparts I had seen in hell. I had to labor among those mortals and spirits who thronged them, and impress their minds with a sense of what I had seen in that dark sphere far below. I knew I could only make them dimly conscious of it, only arouse a little their dormant sense of fear of future retribution for their present misdeeds, but even that was something and would help to deter some from a too complete abandonment of themselves to selfish pleasure. Moreover, Amongst the spirits who were earthbound to those cities I found many whom I could assist, with the knowledge and strength which I had gained in my journey. There ever is and ever must be ample work for those who work upon the earth plane, for multitudinous as are the workers there, more are always being wanted, since men are passing over from earth life every hour and every minute, who need all the help that can be given them. Thus passed some months for me, and then I began once more to feel the old restless longing to rise higher myself, to attain more than I had yet done, to approach nearer to that sphere to which my beloved one would pass when her earthly life was ended, and by attaining which I could alone hope to be united to her in the spirit world. I used to at this time be tormented with a constant fear lest my darling should pass from earth before I had risen to her spiritual level, and thus I should again be parted from her. This fear it was which had ever urged me on to fresh efforts, fresh conquests over myself, and now made me dissatisfied even with the progress I had made. I knew that I had overcome much, I had struggled hard to improve, and I had risen wonderfully fast, yet in spite of all I was still tormented by the jealous and suspicious feelings which my disposition and my earthly experience had gathered about me. There were even times when I would begin to doubt the constancy of my beloved herself. In spite of all the many proofs of her love which she had given me, I would fear lest while I was away from her someone yet in the flesh should after all win her love from me. And thus I was in danger of becoming earth-bound by reason of my unworthy desire to watch her continually. Ah! You who think a spirit has changed all his thoughts and desires at the moment of dissolution, how little you understand of the conditions of that other life beyond the grave, and how slowly, how very slowly we change the habits of thought we have cultivated in our earthly lives or how long they cling to us in the spiritual state. I was then in character much what I had been on earth, only a little better, only learning by degrees wherein my ideas had been wrong and full of prejudice, a lesson we may go on learning through many spheres, higher than any I had attained to. Even while I doubted and feared, I was ashamed of my doubts and knew how unjust they were, yet could I not free myself from them. The experiences of my earth life had taught me suspicion and distrust, and the ghosts of that earth life were not so easily laid. It was while I was in this state of self-torment that Ahinzaman came to me and told me how I might free myself from these haunting shadows of the past. "There is," said he, "a land not far from here called the Land of Remorse. Were you to visit it, the journey would be of much service to you, for once its hills and valleys were passed and its difficulties overcome, the true nature of your earthly life and its mistakes would be clearly realized and prove a great means of progression for your soul."